But I don't want him touching me. Ted has his arm around Jane and they are drinking from the bottle and nuzzling each other. The next time Ted offers the bottle to us, Reuben shakes his head and says we've had enough. There is no place to walk except to town, and there is nothing open there except the Pizza Hut and the movie. But the movie began at 8:15. Besides, I saw it 2 years ago and it was a bore. The boys are starving, so we go into the Pizza Hut and choose a booth near the back. The boys count their money. Between them, they have $8.64. They decide to split a medium pizza with extra cheese and sausage. We order a pitcher of Cokes, and after the waitress brings it, Ted takes the bottle of vodka out of his jacket pocket and pours a couple of shots into his Coke and then into Jane's. Jane's face is red, and she is laughing and slobbering all over the place. I don't like to see my friends drunk. Linnea once said that if I drank myself, I wouldn't feel so uncomfortable. But I don't like the way I feel when I drink, and I don't like the way I feel after either. I once drank beer until I got sick and I hated it. When we go back outside, Jane begins to sing, and she spins around and around in the parking lot, her arms open wide, like a whirling dervish. I can't believe that this is my friend, Jane, who seems shy and innocent and scared of the world. It's freezing, Ted says. Let's warm up in a car. What car? I ask. Any car, Ted says, looking around the parking lot. They're all at the movies. They won't be out until 10:30. He goes from car to car, trying the doors, and on the fifth try, he finds one that opens. It is a blue four-wheel drive Subaru. Ted and Jane climb into the back seat, leaving the front for Reuben and me. I don't like this. The owner of the car could appear at any minute, and then what? We could be arrested, and our parents would be called. I'd never hear the end of it from Walter and Bitsy. Can't wait to take driver's ed, Reuben says. Hitching around town is such a bitch. I live way out on Barranca. He rubs his hands together. Wish we had the key to the ignition. At least we could have a little heat. Make your own, Ted calls from the back seat. He and Jane laugh hysterically. Then Ted rolls down the window and tosses the empty bottle of vodka into the parking lot. We hear the sound of the glass smashing. Jane and Ted are making out. I am aware of every grunt, every sigh, and I can't help thinking that for someone without experience, Jane doesn't seem to be having much trouble. Reuben and I sit like zombies, frozen to our seats, and not just because it is cold. We stare straight ahead, not talking, not touching, not even glancing at each other. I know that he wishes he could be someplace else, just like I do. We are both uncomfortable but don't know how to get out of the situation. I try to block the sounds from the back seat by thinking of the canyon. But then Jane whimpers. I am not feeling very well. I'm feeling kind of... Let her out. Let her out, Ted calls nervously, and both Reuben and I open our doors. Jane gets out just in time. She throws up all over the rear end of the Subaru. Reuben and I are relieved. For the first time, we look at each other and smile. Now we have an excuse to go home. But Jane is really out of it, and we have to half carry, half drag her there. When we get to her house, I say goodnight to the boys. I am feeling much friendlier toward Reuben now, especially since he didn't try anything in the car. See you Monday, he says to me. Right, Monday, I say. Howard's car is gone and the front door is unlocked. I push it open slowly. I am a wreck trying to think of what I will say to Jane's parents. I rehearse a speech in my mind. Jane isn't feeling too well, I'll explain. She had a pizza downtown and it was just too much for her after your wonderful dinner, Mrs. Albertson. Actually, she got sick in the parking lot. Of course, it could be that she's coming down with the flu. There's a lot of it going around in school. Suppose her mother smells the booze and says, you're a liar, Davy Wexler, and you're a bad influence on our little girl. We never should have let her invite you to spend the night. The house is very quiet. I hold my breath. and somehow I managed to get Jane upstairs and into her room, without her parents knowing. I remember that it is Saturday night. Jane's mother and father are probably locked into their bedroom making love. Or maybe they did it while we were out and now they're sleeping. I don't want to think about sex anymore. It was bad enough listening to Ted and Jane. I get Jane undressed down to her shirt and her underpants, pull the covers up around her, then climb into the bedroll her mother has set out for me. I fall asleep quickly and dream about Wolf, about the two of us together in our cave. It is not the first time I have dreamed about him. Chapter 22. The next morning at 7:30, there's a knock on our door. "Rise and shine," Jane's mother calls. "Breakfast is ready. We have to be at church before 9. Jane rolls over, moans, then sits up and says, "Oh, my God. It's Sunday." She holds her hands to her head. "I feel terrible. I think I'm dying. Or did I die last night? What happened?" "You don't remember?" I say. "I remember the Pizza Hut and drinking all that vodka." "And the car? You remember the car?" "What car?" "In the parking lot." "No." "You and Ted were in the back seat?"
"No."
"And then you got sick?"
"I did."
"Come on, Jane. You must remember."
"No,"
she says, shaking her head. "I don't." A thought pops into my mind. Jane thinks she has no experience with boys. But the truth is, she has plenty of experience. She just doesn't remember. "You shouldn't drink," I tell her.
"I drank too much, that's all."
"You shouldn't drink at all if you can't handle it."
"It makes me feel good. It loosens me up. Otherwise, I'm shy around boys."
"You'd never know it from last night."
"That's exactly what I'm trying to tell you."
Jane gets out of bed.
"I've got to take a shower. Will you come to church with us?"
"I don't think so," I say.
"Please, Davy. I can't stand the idea of being alone with my parents this morning."
I don't respond.
"As a friend," Jane says. "Do it as a friend."
"Oh, all right," I say.
"Thanks. I won't forget this."
Jane dashes down the hall to the bathroom, and I begin to get dressed, wondering why I'm feeling so angry at her.
Was it the drinking? No, I don't think so. Then what?
The making out in the back seat?
Yes, maybe. But why?
Because I wanted to be making out too? Because I wanted to feel strong arms around me again? Is that it? There are more churches in Los Alamos than I have ever seen anywhere. There is a church on practically every corner. I don't know if it's because scientists pray more than other people or what. Maybe they have more guilt and fear. I once read an article in Time magazine that said organized religion is based on guilt and fear. I wouldn't know. Both of my parents are half Jewish. For a while, we went to the Unitarian Fellowship in Atlantic City, and after that, we tried Temple Sinai. Now we don't go anywhere. That afternoon, I go to the canyon, hoping to find Wolf. It is cold and gray. I wait for 2 hours, but he doesn't show. I ride home slowly with tears in my eyes. I can't seem to get rid of the empty feeling that started last night and won't go away. Chapter 23. "Do you think we'll go home for Christmas?" I ask Mom. She is in bed reading. She puts her book aside and makes room for me to sit on the bed next to her. I stretch out, examine my fingernails, and begin to peel off the putrid purple polish. "I thought you understood," Mom says.
"Understood what?"
"That we're staying for the school year."
"No,"
I say, sitting straight up. You never said that. Nobody ever said that. I can't go back, Davy. What are you talking about? What do you mean you can't go back? I drop the bits of polish that I have peeled off my nails. They scatter to the floor like tiny flowers that have died. I can't go back now, Mom says. I'm not ready. There's still too much to deal with. I'm just beginning to get myself together. I have a long way to go. Why didn't you tell me? I ask. All this time I've been thinking that we'll be home by Christmas. No, honey. That would be the worst time to go home. Don't you see? Besides, you're all set in school now. It wouldn't make sense to pull you out in the middle of the year. And Jason is happy too. This is a nice place. You like it, don't you? I don't know. Some days I do and some days I don't. But I never thought we were staying. Never. Well, neither did I, Mom says. But Bitsy and Walter are such a help and they want us to stay. Do I have to keep eating bran in my cereal? Mom laughs. Do I? It's good for you. I bend over and pick the tiny ovals of polish from the floor, cupping them in my hand. If we are staying, then I want to learn to ski. Everyone is talking about ski season. If there's enough snow, the ski area will be open before Christmas. We'll talk about it with Walter and Bitsy, Mom says. Okay? When we do, Walter says, it's out of the question. But everyone skis, I tell him. That's an exaggeration, Walter says. Well, maybe not everybody, because you and Bitsy don't, but Jane's whole family skis, except for her mother. I'm not going to argue about this, Davy, Walter says. My mind is made up. I'll give you my reasons. Number one, it's dangerous. Number two, it's expensive. Number three, it's an overrated, trendy sport. You can go ice skating instead. We have a very nice skating pond that will be frozen soon. But I already know how to ice skate, I tell him. Good, then you're all set. You don't understand, I say. That's what you say to us every time we don't respond in the way you want us to respond. I feel frustrated, unsure of what Walter has just said. Walter twists words and confuses me. It's impossible to argue with him and win. So I shout, damn it! And Walter says calmly, let's keep emotion out of this conversation. Let's hold it to logic, pure and simple. I look over to my mother for support. I'm sure Walter knows much more about skiing than we do, Davy, she says. But he doesn't ski, I argue. Maybe not, Mom says. But he knows about it. Besides, Bitsy says, we know a family whose daughter was on the ski team, and she crashed into a tree head first and wound up a vegetable in an Albuquerque hospital. They visit her every Sunday, but she doesn't recognize them. You don't want to wind up a vegetable, do you? What kind of vegetable? Jason asks. She's probably better off than I am, I shout. She doesn't have to live in this house. What's wrong with this house? Bitsy says. What kind of vegetable? Jason asks again. A turnip, I tell him, storming out of the room. Really? Jason says. A turnip? Chapter 24. I look forward to candy striping each week, especially to my visit with Mr. Ortiz. He is the only patient who has been in the hospital since my first day there. We have become friends. But it's hard for me to see him losing his strength. Each week there's a change for the worse. His cheeks are sunken now, and his body seems to be withering away. Last week I saw him without his dental bridge, and he looked ancient, even though I know from his chart that he is only 57. Through it all, he remains cheerful. I don't understand how someone so sick, so close to death, can still enjoy what little of life is left. Mr. Ortiz likes to hear about school, and he has decided that I should go out for the swim team. I've explained a dozen times that I can't dive, that I hardly ever swim with my face in the water. But he says I can learn, that I am built like a swimmer. He regrets never having learned to swim himself, but his son was the star of the high school team, and for 3 years, Mr. Ortiz never missed a meet. I promise him that I will think about swimming, but the truth is, I am more interested in trying out for the school play. It's going to be a production of Oklahoma, and scripts and music are available at the drama department office, even though tryouts are still a few months away. I doubt that a sophomore has a chance at a major role, but there is always the chorus, and it would be nice to sing again, outside of the shower. When I am candy striping, I save Mr. Ortiz's room for last, so that I can spend extra time with him. Today, as I walk down the corridor, I see that his door is closed, and I get a sinking feeling. I have told myself over and over that I must prepare for Mr. Ortiz's death, but I haven't been able to. Not yet. I knock softly on the door, then push it open, and feel a great sense of relief when I see Mr. Ortiz lying in his bed. "Come," he says softly when he sees that it is me. "Come and meet my son." I look across the room. His son stands with his back to me. His hands are pressed against the window frame. "Martin," Mr. Ortiz says, "this is Davy." Martin turns around, and I can't believe it. It is Wolf. We stare at each other. Finally, he says, "Hello," as if we have never met. I try to say hello too, but my voice cracks. I cough, clear my throat twice, and say it again. "Hello." "Martin was captain of the swim team," Mr. Ortiz says, "and co-captain of the soccer team, and the National Merit Scholarship winner, and runner-up in the Westinghouse Science Contest, and—" "Come on, Dad," Wolf says gently. He looks at the floor and refuses to meet my eyes. His hair tumbles across his face. "He doesn't like to talk about himself," Mr. Ortiz says, as if I don't already know. "And now he's got a full scholarship to Caltech," Mr. Ortiz continues. "He's a junior, and he's going to be a brilliant physicist." "Hey, Dad," Wolf says, "give me a break." Wolf finally looks directly at me as if to say, "Don't listen to any of this crap. That's not the real me." He is embarrassed by his father's enthusiastic outburst, but doesn't want to hurt his feelings either. I want to tell him that it's okay, that I understand. "You should be proud," Mr. Ortiz tells him. "Look at all you've done in your life, and you're only 20 years old. Mr. Ortiz closes his eyes. Talking this much has worn him down. When he opens them again, his voice is weaker, and I have to stand close to hear what he is saying.
"So what do you think? I'm a lucky man, no?"
"Yes," I say.
"And he's handsome too."
I nod.
"Someday, he's going to have a big job at the lab. Group leader, division leader, maybe even director."
"We'll see, Dad," Wolf says.
"We'll see."
Mr. Ortiz holds the dancing bear out to Wolf.
"Wind it for her," he says. "She likes to see it dance."
Wolf winds up the bear and sets it on the table, where it dances in circles, until it wears down, moving more and more slowly until it stops completely. Like Mr. Ortiz, I think. Mr. Ortiz closes his eyes and whispers,
"I have to sleep now."
Wolf kisses his father's cheek. "See you tonight, Dad." We walk out of the room together. At first, we don't speak. We walk down the corridor to the elevator and I push the button.
"You're surprised to see me here," Wolf says. Surprised is an understatement.
"Yes," I tell him. "I'm surprised."
"Aren't you surprised to see me?"
"Sure. How come I haven't seen you here before?" I ask.
"I've been working at the lab in the afternoons. I took the semester off to be with my father.
I usually visit here at night. The elevator door opens and we step into it. There are two nurses and a doctor standing to one side. I'll drive you home, Wolf says.
I have to get my things, I tell him. I'll wait outside, he says.
Okay. I'll only be a minute.
I grab my jacket and books from the closet in the volunteer's office and dash down the hall to the revolving door. Jane is there waiting for me, her hat pulled down over her forehead.
I've got a ride home, I tell her.
I push my way through the revolving door. Jane is right behind me. Outside, Wolf waits in a battered Toyota pickup truck. He toots his horn at me. I wave.
See you tomorrow, I tell Jane.
She looks confused and hurt. I don't blame her, but I don't have the time to explain now. I get into Wolf's truck and we take off.
I live in the western area, I say. Only a few blocks from here, on 45th Street.
Wolf nods. He knows his way around town.
I didn't know you were going to be a physicist, I say, glancing sideways at him.
I don't know if I am, Wolf says.
But your father said,
it's what he wants for me.
You must be very smart, I say.
Wolf laughs. I fiddle with the pom-pom on my hat, which I hold on my lap.
What did you mean, it's what he wants?
Just that. He has my life all planned.
I think about Mr. Ortiz and the way he decided I should go out for the swim team without finding out if I have an interest in swimming. I think about Jane's parents and how her father wants her to go to MIT and her mother wants her to go to Wellesley. I think about Walter and the way he is pushing me to go to college without finding out what's important to me.
I nod at Wolf. I understand what he is saying.
What do you want? I ask him.
That's the big question, Tiger, he says.
And I haven't come up with the answer yet.
This is it, I say, as we pull up in front of the house. Wolf turns off the engine and looks at me.
Did your father die of cancer? Is that why you're so close to mine?
No, I say. My father... I pause, about to tell him the truth, but then I change my mind and say, my father died suddenly.
It's tough either way, he says, isn't it?
Yes. He rests his head on his arms, on the steering wheel. I lean over and touch his hand.
Will I see you at the canyon over the weekend?
No, I'm spending all of my time with my father now. I nod.
Then I'll see you next week, at the hospital.
He doesn't respond. And even as I say it, I know that by next week it could be over. That by then, Mr. Ortiz could be dead. I open the door on my side of the truck.
Wolf sits up.
Goodbye, Tiger.
I nod again. If I try to speak now, I know I will cry.
I get out of the truck and run into the house.
Who was that in the pickup truck? Jane asks the next day.
A friend.
I know that, but who?
Mr. Ortiz's son?
He's cute.
There are things that matter more than being cute, I snap.
Jane's face turns red and tears spring to her eyes. I walk away feeling like a creep. That night I call her.
I'm sorry.
I don't know what's wrong with you, Davy, Jane says.
Nothing, I tell her. It's just hard to see Mr. Ortiz dying, that's all.
We're not supposed to become emotionally involved with the patients.
I know, but I'm human. I can't help it.
There's a long pause. Finally, Jane says,
look, we're going down to Santa Fe on Saturday to do some last-minute Christmas shopping. You want to come?
Sure, I say.
I'd like that.
At dinner the next night, my mother says,
I'm thinking seriously of looking for a job after Christmas. Something part-time.
A casual, Walter suggests, buttering his baked potato.
A casual what? I ask. That's what we call part-time employees at the lab, Walter explains. I think I can help, he tells Mom. Maybe pull a few strings.
That would be wonderful, Mom says. I've got to get into a routine. I need some place to go every morning. A reason to get out of bed.
I get out of bed because I have to pee, Jason says.
Not at the table, Bitsy tells him.
No, not at the table, Jason says. In the bathroom.
I begin to laugh. Once I get started, I can't stop. I laugh and I laugh until my side is splitting.
Chapter 25. In Santa Fe, I feel so exhilarated. I can't get enough of the street life and the people. I realize that one of the things I miss most about Atlantic City is people watching. I used to go to the boardwalk and just watch, fascinated. In Los Alamos, there is no one to watch, except the housewives in the supermarket, and even they have a sameness I find boring. In Santa Fe, the tourists mingle with the natives, the Spanish, the Anglos, the Native Americans all together. We walk around the plaza, admiring the windows of the shops and the festive decorations. This part of Santa Fe seems to be a village, not a city. It reminds me of Christmas in Other Lands, a book we studied in fourth grade. I feel as if I am in another land. I see a window full of piñatas. I want to buy one for our family, but when I go into the store and price them, they are too expensive. The Palace of the Governors dates back to 1609, Jane tells me. Groups of Indians sit under its portal, displaying their wares on colorful blankets. There are delicate silver and turquoise earrings and necklaces, strings of heishi, chunky silver bracelets and rings. I want to buy something for my mother. I go from blanket to blanket, admiring everything, and finally decide on a pair of earrings. They are $10, which is more than I can afford, but I splurge because they are so pretty. After a while, we go to the French pastry shop, which is adjacent to La Fonda Hotel. We order apricot tarts and herb tea. When we have finished, Jane asks her parents if she and I can shop on our own for the rest of the afternoon. Yes, but be careful, her mother says. Stay off the side streets and don't speak to any strangers. Outside, the Albertsons head in one direction, and Jane and I in the other. As we are walking up Palace Avenue, a group of boys comes toward us. Jane clutches my arm.
What is it? I ask.
She is trembling.
They're Spanish, she whispers.
So?
Don't look at them. Look away. Look across the street.
Jane, I say and start to laugh.
Do you know how high the rape statistics are in this town? She whispers.
No, I tell her.
High. Nobody's going to rape you in the middle of the afternoon, in the middle of town. Don't be so sure.
The boys pass us.
You see, Jane says. Didn't I tell you?
What?
Didn't you hear them?
Hear them what?
Make those sounds.
No, I say. I didn't hear anything. I don't think they even noticed us.
They're all like that, Jane says anyway. They're all out to rape Anglo girls.
Jane, that is one of the craziest things I've ever heard. We stop walking and face each other.
You're new around here, she says.
You don't understand. I think of Wolf and inside my head I say, no, you're the one who doesn't understand. We browse in the Velagra bookstore, where I find a paperback copy of Computing for Fun. I think of Walter immediately. He could use a little fun. And since he is so into computers, I buy it for him.
I get a small leather pouch for Jason in a shop down the street. He can keep marbles in it, or stones he has found, or shells when we go back home. I know he will like it. At Dudelet's, a funny little shop crammed full of gifts with cat motifs, I get Bitsy a potholder with a cat face on it, and a set of catnip toys for Minka. I buy two rolls of cat wrapping paper,
And while Jane is off searching for gifts for her family, I bought her a catmobile to hang in her room. There, my shopping is finished. I feel very good about it. I am almost wiped out financially, but maybe I can pick up a babysitting job over the holidays. And then I see the candle. It is round, with 5 wicks on top, and depicts the New Mexican sunset. My father would love it, I think. He collected unusual candles, and then waited for special occasions to light them. "Would you like one?" a saleswoman says to me. "They're just $3.95. "Yes," I tell her, "but I'm going to have to return one of these rolls of wrapping paper." "All right," she says. "I'll credit you $2.50 for the paper." I reach into my wallet and pull out my last $2. The saleswoman wraps the candle in tissue paper, and I put it into the bag with the other gifts. I won't tell anyone I bought a present for my father. Who would understand? Jane and I meet her parents for an early dinner at the Steaksmith, and when we come out of the restaurant, the farolitos, which line the flat-topped roofs of the buildings downtown, have been lit. They are candles set in sand, inside brown paper bags, and are the traditional New Mexican Christmas decorations. The plaza looks beautiful, outlined in soft lights. Jane's parents walk hand in hand. Tonight, they remind me of my parents, happy and loving. Tears come to my eyes. This must be a very hard time of year for my mother, I think, facing the holidays without Daddy. When we get back to the car, we see that someone has written on the hood with a magic marker, "Los Alamos sucks." The Albertsons don't say anything, but they look at each other in a way that lets me know this isn't the first time it has happened. "How did they know we were from Los Alamos?" I ask Jane. "The LASL sticker," she says. "Oh, right. I forgot." Every car that has parking privileges at the lab has an ID sticker in the front window. It makes me angry, this two-way hatred. I don't understand it. I wonder how much of it is caused by fear. The lovely mood is spoiled. I fall asleep on the ride home. Chapter 26. On Christmas morning, Bitsy brings out a menorah. "It belonged to your great-grandmother," she tells Jason and me. Even though Hanukkah fell early this year, we light all 8 candles and recite the Hanukkah blessing. Then we go into the living room and open our presents, which are under the tree. It is nice to celebrate both holidays, I think. If I ever have kids, that's what I'll do. We have a quiet Christmas. A sad Christmas. Although each of us pretends to be happy, pretends to be excited by our gifts, underneath, we are all thinking the same thing. It is our first Christmas without Daddy. But we don't talk about it. Bitsy and Walter have invited some people in for Christmas dinner. 2 men from the lab, both of them divorced and lonely. A single woman they have known for years and a young kindergarten teacher who belongs to Bitsy's Tuesday night group. I think it is nice that Bitsy and Walter have asked these people to join us, even though the kindergarten teacher drinks too much wine and gets silly. And I don't like the way one of the divorced men keeps looking at my mother. That night when the company has left, when the dishes have been washed and dried and put away, I go to my room and take my father's present out of the trunk. "Daddy, this is for you." I light all 5 wicks on the candle and watch as the New Mexican sunset disappears. "Merry Christmas, Daddy. I wish you were here." In 15 minutes, there is nothing left. Nothing at all. Except a pile of wax. The next day it snows. I sit in front of the picture window in the living room, watching the flakes fall. My breath makes the glass frosty. Chapter 27. Mr. Ortiz is in a coma. He will probably never wake up. Wolf sits at his bedside, an opened book on his lap. But he is not reading. He never turns the pages. I ask if I can get anything for him.
A Coke would be good,
he says. I bring him one from the machine. The nurses on the floor assure me that Mr. Ortiz is not in pain, that soon it will be over. That evening, Wolf drives me home.
I'm going to miss you, Tiger, he says.
What do you mean? I ask. Where are you going?
Away.
Now?
No, but soon.
After.
Will I see you again?
Yes.
When?
He thinks for a minute.
Then he says, Cuando los lagartillos corren.
What does that mean?
Look it up, he says, and he smiles. It is the first time I have seen him smile in a long time.
I'm going to miss you too, I tell him. He takes me in his arms and we don't speak again. He holds me close, patting my hair. I rest my cheek against the rough wool of his sweater.
Who was that?
Bitsy asks when I go inside.
Who was who?
In that truck. Outside.
Just now.
Oh, that was a friend of mine, I say, anxious to get up to my room. I want to write down what Wolf has just said to me before I forget it.
What friend? Bitsy asks.
You don't know him.
Maybe I do.
His name is Martin Ortiz, I say, walking toward the stairs.
Ortiz? Bitsy repeats, following me.
Yes.
Does he go to the high school?
Not anymore.
He's a dropout?
I didn't say that.
Well,
why don't you just tell me about him, Davy, instead of playing 20 questions?
You're the one playing 20 questions, not me, I say.
Bitsy takes a deep breath.
Is he Spanish?
I guess.
You guess?
I never asked him.
Where is he from? Española?
No, he's from here. He's from Los Alamos.
He is?
Yes, he works at the lab.
What does he do there?
Maintenance. I almost laugh. I almost laugh and say, yes, he picks up the garbage. Just to see her reaction. But I don't. I'm very polite. I say, his father is a patient at the medical center. He goes to Caltech, but he's taking the semester off.
Well, Bitsy says, her voice full of relief. Why didn't you say so in the first place?
I hold up my hands as if to say, search me, then race up the stairs to my room.
I take out my notebook and write, Cuando los lagartijos corren.
I know I haven't spelled it correctly, but at least I will remember it this way. Tomorrow I will go to the Spanish department at school and ask one of the teachers what it means.
Cuando los lagartijos corren,
Mr. Valdez says, writing it down in my notebook.
Oh,
I say, embarrassed by my errors.
What does it mean?
It means when the lizards run.
Does that make sense to you?
He asks. I smile.
Yes,
I tell him.
Yes, it does.
I try saying it myself.
Cuando los lagartijos corren.
You've got a good ear,
Mr. Valdez says.
You should take Spanish.
I'm going to. Next year, I say.
Cuando los lagartijos corren.
When the lizards run, I say to myself all during my next class, which is geometry. I'll see Wolf in the springtime, in the canyon. I say it over and over inside my head, until the teacher calls on me to draw a trapezoidal figure on the board, and I have no idea what she's talking about. My mother has been hired as a casual at the lab. She moves around from group to group, depending on who needs her services, like a substitute teacher. She types and files and answers the phone, and she likes it. It makes her feel useful again, she says. It gives her a sense of purpose. I'm not about to argue with her, but I can't see typing at the lab as useful or having much to do with purpose. It seems to me she would have more purpose by being a real mother to Jason and me. On Saturday morning during breakfast, I decide to bring up the subject of driver's ed. I've been thinking about it ever since Reuben mentioned it in the car the night Jane got drunk. The notice just went up on the bulletin board outside the office at school. You have to sign up before February 1st to get into the spring class. I hand out information to my mother and to Bitsy and Walter, asking them to read it when they have a chance. Then I go upstairs to clean my room. I want to drive so badly. If only I could drive, I could get to Santa Fe. I could watch the people and browse around, and most of all, just get out of this town. This town suffers from a chronic case of the blahs. An hour later, I am folding the laundry with my mother, while Jason and Bitsy bake an angel food cake. Walter sits at the table, a mess of papers spread out in front of him. He is working on his mini computer. So if I sign up now, I've got a good chance of being accepted into driver's ed this spring. I say it quietly. If I keep emotion out of my voice, I will do better with Walter, and I know that he is the one I've got to convince. 15 is much too young for driver's ed, Walter says, not even looking up from his computer. I'll be 16 in April. There's just no reason to rush it, Davy, Bitsy says. She cracks several eggs, separating the whites from the yolks. Everyone my age is signing up, I say, as I fold a towel in thirds. Jane's parents gave her permission. I'm quiet and matter of fact, as if I don't really care at all. When you're a senior, that's time enough, Walter says over his shoulder. But that's 2 years from now. How am I supposed to get around until then?
You can walk, Walter says, or you can ride a bicycle. You've managed until now. You'll manage a little longer.
I face Mom and say, Mom, please. I really want to take driver's ed. It's very important to me. All you have to do is sign the little green card. Mom looks at me and we make eye contact for the first time in months. Then just as she is about to speak, Walter says,
Statistics show that accidents, especially automobile accidents, are the leading cause of death among young people.
Why go looking for trouble? Bitsy says. She pours the batter into the cake pan, and Jason pulls the oven door open for her. Mom, say something. Will you?
Walter and Bitsy know what's best, Mom says.
Since when? Since when, I'd like to know? I explode now. I don't care about logic or emotion or anything. Can't you think for yourself anymore? Do you have to let them decide everything?
I spin around. Jason is drinking a glass of milk and listening intently. I turn back to my mother and point my finger at her accusingly.
You're getting to be just like them. You know that? Just like them. That's enough, Walter shouts, slamming his hand on the table. No, it's not enough, I shout back. I'm sick of hearing how dangerous everything is.
Driving a car is dangerous, Mom says.
Oh, please. Spare me, will you?
I yell at Mom.
Dangerous, dangerous, dangerous. Stay out of the canyon, Davy. You could be hit by a falling rock. Don't forget your bicycle helmet, Davy. You could get hit by a car. No, you can't learn to ski, Davy. You might wind up a vegetable.
I am really yelling now. Davy, honey. Mom begins and she reaches for me, but I pull away from her.
Some people have lived up here so long, they've forgotten what the real world is like, I shout. And the idea of it scares the... You can just stop it right now,
Walter says, before I have finished. He says it slowly, making every word count.
You're a good one to talk, I tell him. You're the one who's making the bombs. You're the one who's figuring out how to blow up the whole world. But you won't let me take driver's ed.
A person can get killed crossing the street. A person can get killed minding his own store. Did you ever think of that?
I kick the wall and stomp out of the room. I'm crying hard and my throat feels sore.
We have a long way to go with that girl, I hear Walter mutter.
Then Mom says, it's hard to be 15. Chapter 28. Walter's chamber music group is giving a concert at our house. Bitsy tells me to wear a skirt. What for? I say. It's a dress-up concert, she answers. It's a festive occasion.
It's not my concert, I tell her. It's not a festive occasion to me.
Bitsy taps her foot and glares at me.
Oh, all right, I say. If it's that important to you, I'll wear a skirt.
I run upstairs feeling angry, partly at Bitsy and partly at myself. I don't mean to act rude, but sometimes I can't help myself. Bitsy and Walter say that ever since the driver's ed incident, I have a chip on my shoulder. They say that as long as I live in their house, I have to live by their rules. Maybe so, but that doesn't mean I have to like them or even accept them. I toss on the skirt Mom gave me for Christmas. It is blue denim and tiered, and the truth is, I like it. I don't mind changing out of my jeans. I might have done it on my own. It was having Bitsy tell me to do it that got my back up. I wear the skirt with boots and a loose white sweater. I have to pick a dozen cat hairs off it. Minka must have been sleeping in my sweater drawer. When I forget to close my dresser drawers, she hops right in and makes herself at home. I am the only one in the living room when the doorbell rings. I open the door. It is Ned Grudzinski, one of the men who came to our house for Christmas dinner. He is filling in tonight for the woman who usually plays violin.
Hello, Darby, Ned says, stuttering over the D.
It's Davy, I tell him. Ned looks like the nerd in the National Lampoon poster. He carries 6 pens in his shirt pocket. His high-water pants show off his white socks and his hair is short and slicked down. He is also the one who kept staring at my mother on Christmas Day. I am not overjoyed to see him again. Fortunately, I don't have to spend any time alone with him. The doorbell rings every few minutes, and soon the house is filled with guests. Jason and I sit on the floor in front of the fireplace. The others sit on the sofas and a group of chairs from the dining room, which Bitsy has arranged in rows. The musicians tune up and the concert begins. Walter plays the viola. A woman with a long gray braid plays the violin. A bald man with a beard is on cello, and Ned plays second violin. Jason yawns constantly. Every time I see him yawn, I yawn. Although it is only 8 o'clock, and neither one of us should feel tired. There's something about chamber music that makes you want to go to sleep. Maybe that's why they call it chamber music. When the concert is finally over, everyone applauds and Bitsy serves coffee and cake. Jason and I both stuff ourselves. Bitsy pours a cup for the nerd and says, Ned, you remember our sister-in-law Gwen Wexler, don't you?
How could I forget?
Ned says, and this time he doesn't stutter at all. Mom shakes his hand and says, the concert was just lovely.
My regular group plays on Fridays, Ned tells Mom.
Bitsy is all smiles as she excuses herself and moves on to her other guests. I stay close to Mom.
Would you like to hear us sometime?
Ned asks her.
When?
Mom says.
This Friday? Next? The week after?
Well, Mom says, laughing, only it's not her regular laugh. It's a high-pitched, nervous kind of laugh.
I'm divorced, Ned says.
Yes, I know, Mom says. I'm a widow. I can't believe this.
Walter told me,
Ned says, nodding seriously. Jason whispers something to me, but I shake him away. I am steaming. Why doesn't Mom just tell the nerd to bug off? Why is she going through this I'm a widow business?
So, Ned says, I hear you're working at the lab now.
Well, I'm only a casual,
Mom says.
What group are you in?
She is beginning to sound just like one of them.
I'm in H division.
H is for health.
H is for hick, I think.
H is for horrible.
H is for hyena.
Now Mom and the nerd stand silently and just look at each other. I can't understand why she would waste her time talking to him.
Will you have lunch with me tomorrow?
Ned finally says.
Tomorrow?
Mom repeats. She is acting so dumb I want to slug her.
Yes, tomorrow, he says.
And if you say no, I won't bother you again. I don't know how to go about this anyway. I'm beginning to feel very foolish.
Good, I think. Now just say no, Mom, and that will be the end of it.
But instead, Mom says,
yes, I'll have lunch with you.
Great! Ned is so pleased he can't stop grinning. Do you know where you'll be working tomorrow?
P division.
I'll pick you up outside at noon. I have a white Datsun, but it's dirty so it looks gray.
Mom laughs.
I'm sure we'll recognize each other.
Well then, see you tomorrow.
Right.
Later, when everyone has gone home, I go up to Mom's room. She is looking in the mirror, holding a red sweater up to her face.
What do you think?
She asks me.
I can't understand why you said you'd have lunch with him, I tell her. He's such a nerd.
Oh, come on, honey.
He's a nice man.
He's shy, that's all. I can't believe you're going out on a date.
It's not a date, Mom says, putting the red sweater away.
We're having lunch together, that's all.
I call that a date, I say.
Well, I don't, Mom answers.
Chapter 29. On Tuesday afternoon, when I get to the medical center, I save a rose from one of the floral arrangements I've delivered to a patient and carry it down the hall to Mr. Ortiz's room. But when I get there, the room is empty. The bed has been stripped. I race down the hall to the nurse's station.
Mr. Ortiz?
I say. The nurse shakes her head. Last night, she says.
No!
I'm sorry, Davy. We all felt the same way about him. I choke up and clutch the stem of the rose so hard a thorn goes through my skin. I cry out, half from the pain in my finger and half from the pain of losing Mr. Ortiz. His son asked me to give you these, the nurse says, opening a drawer. She pulls out the dancing bear and an envelope and hands them both to me. I open the envelope. Tiger. He wanted you to have the bear. Remember him as he was. Full of life, full of love.
I'll see you cuando los lagartillos corren, Wolf.
I put the note back in its envelope and hold the dancing bear to my face. I can't stop crying. I am crying harder now than when my father died. Then I was just numb. Now I feel everything. I go downstairs to the volunteer's office and explain to the director that I have to go home. I tell her I have a headache, which is true. My head is pounding. The director tells me to go home and take 2 aspirin. She thinks I am probably coming down with the flu. I run all the way home, sweating inside my down jacket. When I get there, Jason is in the kitchen wearing an apron.
What are you doing? I shout. What does it look like I'm doing? And why are you wearing that faggy apron?
So I don't get messed up, he says.
Where's Mom?
She's not home yet.
Where's Bitsy?
She went to Safeway. Ned's coming to dinner.
That nerd!
He's nice, Jason says, and he keeps on cutting out gingerbread man cookies.
God, Jason, just look at you, I yell. Is this how you're going to spend the rest of your life?
What do you mean?
Like this? Baking cookies? I can't stand what's happening to you. I can't stand what's happening to us.
What are you talking about? I like baking cookies.
That's not what I'm talking about.
I go upstairs, throw myself down on my bed, and wind up the dancing bear. I hang over the side of the bed and watch him turning circles on the floor. Why did I have to take it out on Jason? I ask myself. He's just a little kid. What does he know? Besides, what happened to my fantasy of Jason Wexler cookie specialist? Just thinking about that sets me off crying again.
I want to go home,
I say aloud.
I want to go home to Atlantic City.
Later, I decide to write a letter. Dear Wolf, I'm really sorry about your father. I liked him a lot, as you know. Thanks for remembering about the bear. I'm going to keep him on my bedside table. He will remind me of your father and of you. Not that I need reminding, but you know what I mean. I told you that my father died suddenly. Well, that's true, but it's not like you think. He was shot in the chest during a robbery last summer. I couldn't tell you the truth before. I couldn't tell anyone. Here's the thing, Wolf. Your father was ready to die. Mine wasn't. You were prepared for your father's death. I wasn't. After it happened, I was afraid. I was so afraid of everything, of going to school, of just going to sleep at night. I was afraid of you that first day in the canyon. I was planning to bash in your head with a rock if you made a false move. Lucky for you, you didn't. I don't want to go through life afraid, but I don't want to wind up like my father either. Sometimes I think about dying, and it scares me, because it's so permanent. I mean, once it's over, it's over. Unless there is something that comes after. Something that we don't know about. I like the idea of an afterlife, but I can't bring myself to really believe in it. Do you? Here is something I found in a magazine. Each of us must confront our own fears, must come face to face with them. How we handle our fears will determine where we go with the rest of our lives. To experience adventure, or to be limited by the fear of it. I think about that a lot, especially in this town, where so many people seem afraid. Does building bombs make them feel afraid, or is it the isolation from the rest of the world? Have you figured it out? If you have, please let me know. I have to go now. I will remember your father as you asked me to, full of life and full of love. I will see you cuando los lagartijos corren. Love, Tiger. I take the letter to school the next day and look up the address for Caltech in the guidance office. I mail it at lunchtime. Chapter 30. My letter to Wolf is returned on the same day that my first semester grades come in. The envelope is stamped, moved, no forwarding address. Where is he? I wonder. What is he doing? I put the letter into the trunk, next to ones I have received from Linnea, who writes to me on the first day of every month. In the spring, I will personally hand my letter to Wolf. In the spring, when I see him again. I show my grades to my mother, who is getting ready to go out to dinner with the nerd. She says, "Very nice, Davy. Especially since you missed more than a month of school. I'm sure you did your best." "How come you're going out on another date with him?" I ask. "It's not a date," Mom says. "We're having dinner together, that's all." "Sure," I say. Mom turns away from the mirror where she has been brushing her hair. "I need the adult companionship. I thought you had that all day at the lab." "No, this is different," she tells me. "Well, have a good time," I say, but I don't mean it.